Hey, good morning. This is Saturday, April the 8th, and you are on with John Griffin and Tim Elmore, and I'm going to introduce Tim in just a moment, but I'm going to go through a couple of announcements, and then we'll get right into the call. You've got less than a month away to earn some money and points while referring people to the certified team, and if you remember, the major prize, a major prize, awaits five people who lead that referral pack this season. And that's why it's critical that if you can get your referrals in now, because that way you'll not only earn some money, but you'll get points toward the spring referral contest. Now, for this, you can spend a day, and the date's going to be announced in Atlanta with Chris Robinson, Chris Godey, Roddy Galbraith. There will be private all-day access to mentors for fun, Q&A, and mentorship. Tour the Maxwell Leadership Center at the 12 Stone Church headquarters of Equip, and a custom Porsche driving experience at the home of Porsche in North America. The grand prize winner will also introduce John C. Maxwell at the August 2023 IMC. And speaking of IMC, if you did get your headshots done at this last IMC or your stage shots, those will be emailed out to you by the end of this month, and your personalized videos will be emailed out to you by the end of May. Also, it being April, don't miss our Global Youth Initiative movement, and this is a time for you to lead, participate, or donate. Over the past 5 years, our global Maxwell Leadership Certified team has added value to more than 2 million youth around the world. And so let's just continue to work together, raise these young leaders, and raise that number to 2.5 million. And if you want more information, you can hop on the certification line on Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can learn more. Now, if you're interested in going on a transformation trip, this is your chance, and it's also, as always, only for mentorship. On Tuesday, April the 18th, registration will open for our next transformation trip to Panama, and that's going to be happening July 22nd through the 27th. So join Chris Robinson and Juan Varikin in the Mentorship Facebook group at noon Eastern Time to learn more about this exciting opportunity, and then hop on a Panama launch call at 4 p.m. on the Mentorship line to go over all the registration details and answer your questions. Registration will be on a first-come, first-served basis. You don't want to miss this trip. As we've been hearing more and more about what the team is doing down there, I can't wait to get there myself. All right. So you are in for a treat this morning. We have Dr. Tim Elmore, who is with us. And you all, many of you, if not all of you, of course, know him. And if you don't, where have you been? Dr. Elmore has been, he's written over 35 books. I used to use those books all the time when I was teaching. And his Habitudes books are just all over the place, but his latest book, if you haven't read it, you need to read it. It's called A New Kind of Diversity, and it is phenomenal. But meanwhile, Dr. Elmore is the founder of Growing Leaders and the president, CEO, Grand Poobah, all the above. But he is, what we are really most excited about is he is one of our thought leaders. And you've heard him at IMC, you've heard him at Live to Lead, and I can't wait for you to hear him now. Tim, it is great to have you on the call. I'm going to mute my line and pull out my pen and paper and ready to take some great notes on your teaching, and honored to be here with you.
Thanks, John. Hey, good day, good morning, good evening, everybody around wherever you live. I'm always honored to be on these calls. This is going to be a fun one today. Fun not because it will be easy, but fun because I think it's going to be invigorating. By the way, John, thank you for using the term Grand Poobah. I have never been called Grand Poobah before, but I'm going to embrace that. So, folks, today I want to talk to you about cultivating grit. in both yourself and the team that may be serving with you. In fact, if you were to put a title on this, maybe the pithy title could be Grit or Quit. The more I talk to employers, the more I talk to educators who work with young people, students, the more I say it seems like grit today, that whole resilience, resourcefulness thing, seems to be diminishing. But I don't think it's because people are bad. I just think we live in a world of high tech where things are quick and convenient, you know, on demand, instant access. We don't have to delay much gratification, do we? So it tends to be this grit muscle is not being developed as much as it used to be. So I want to start in with an incredible story. If nothing else, you're going to love this story. And then I want to break it down, talk about what we learn, and then I'm going to open it up for some great conversation. I don't know how many of you on this call have ever heard of Betty Robinson, but you ought to know her. I just recently got acquainted with her, even though she lived 100 years ago. Betty was growing up in the 1920s, about a century ago, as a young girl. She had a challenging upbringing, as many did in the roaring 20s back then, and then, of course, was a teenager during the Great Depression. But her story unfolds with the fact that she began her day, like many kids did, by doing chores, lots of chores to be done. In fact, a lot of kids still lived on a farm where they had farm chores to do. By the time she got dressed and ready for school, she was often running to catch a train. She couldn't be driven. She missed the bus. So she was running on a train platform to catch the train. And very often, she was running alongside a moving train. The train had already taken off from the station, and she was running to try to catch it. Commonly, people would look out the window from the train at this poor young teenager running, and oftentimes they would go, bless her heart, she ain't going to make it, you know. One particular day is a day to remember. Charles Price, who happened to be a teacher and the high school track coach, looked out from his window and saw Betty running, bless her heart, trying to catch the train, and he chuckled this particular day thinking, she's never going to make it. Next thing he knows, he hears books slammed down on the seat right next to him. There's the young girl, Betty Robinson. She had made the train. She had outrun the train. Well, Charles Price, as I mentioned, was not only a school teacher, he was the boys' track team coach. And he said, did I see what I think I saw? And she smiled. She didn't say anything. But he quickly said, I'd like you to try out for the boys' track team. Now, this isn't bizarre today. There's a lot of, you know, cross, you know, girls on boys' team, boys on whatever. But back then, there was no girls' track team. So he said, I want you to try out for the boys' track team. Well, the next thing they know, Betty's the fastest runner on the team. And when Coach Price puts her in her very first competition, she sets a world record in her first race. And she's a high school kid. So this happened to be in 1932, 4 months before the Olympics. And her coach decided, I'm going to train this young lady and take her to her first national competition to see if she can compete and make the Olympics. Well, in her first national competition, she faced the U.S. record holder and came in second to the one that held the record, but she qualified for the Olympics. So I want you just to capture what I've said so far. She's never run officially. You know, she just ran around the farm and ran on the train platform, but she had so developed her own sense of, I'm going to make it, I'm going to make it, I'm going to make it, spirit, that she was now about to compete in the U.S. Olympics, 1928 Olympics. And when she competes, she's a high school junior. That's how old she is. She qualifies for the Amsterdam Olympics, which was the very first Olympics that allowed an Olympic women's track and field team. Well, in her first competition in the Olympics, 1928, Betty Robinson wins a gold medal. And remember, this is the first time they've ever allowed women. So the best women in the world are here, and they've been running for years. But at this point, she wins a gold medal as a teenager. She's got this humble, sheepish little smile on her face. She's not quite sure what to do with it. She went from nothing to, you know, the world stage as a high schooler, thanks to her talent and her grit. Now, I want to underscore that just for a minute. She clearly had talent. There's no doubt about it. She was good at running. But it was her grit that differentiated her from hundreds, maybe thousands of other young runners. Fast forward. The story goes on, and it becomes a little bit of a, well, not a little bit. It becomes a tragedy. Tragedy strikes in 1931. So this was a year before the next Olympic competition. Betty Robinson is involved in a plane crash. It was a small plane crash, meaning small plane, but not a small crash, with a family member. The family member dies, and her condition is so poor that she's taken to the morgue, the undertaker, rather than the hospital. But as she gets to the morgue, they see her flinch, and they realize she's still alive. And so they quickly run her over to the hospital, where they began to nurse her back to health. But once again, Betty's grit keeps her alive. Well, when they finally nurse her back to consciousness, the doctors tell her right away, I just want you to know, you're never going to walk again, much less run again. But after several surgeries, she's up and about, but they realize one leg on her body now is a half inch shorter than the other. And if you ever plan on running again, you know a half an inch is a substantial amount of height. So it takes Betty 2 years to truly learn to walk again. So she misses the Olympics. And then she eventually pushes herself and learns to run. So she's imagining now running at the next Olympics, which would be 1936. But she realizes because one leg is shorter than the other, she can't kneel any longer at the starting blocks. You know how all the runners take a knee and then the gun's fired and they take off. So she can't really compete because she can't get down, and you've got to get in position to run in any kind of a race, the 100 meters, 400 meters, whatever. But she has an epiphany at that point. She realizes she still can race, even if she can't bend over, if she runs on the relay team. So, you know, this is a four-person team. She says, as long as I'm not the first runner, I can take, you know, the anchor spot or one of the other spots and still compete. So Betty joins and qualifies to make the 1936 four-person women's relay team in Berlin as a member of the women's relay team. Now, remember, this is in Berlin, 1936. Adolf Hitler is watching everything from his perch above the track and field. Betty runs her part beautifully. The German team that was expected to win dropped the baton, and the USA team won a gold medal right there in front of Adolf Hitler. Betty Robinson has a couple of gold medals at this point. She's still this young lady with this humble grin. She's adorable. She's got short hair, and she realizes at that point, my talent was good, but my grit is what got me where I needed to go. Now, I don't know about you, but whenever I hear a story like that, I mean, there's Wilma Rudolph. We can talk about that in a little bit. There's all kinds of stories of grit, and they're coming from all places, all industries. But I'd like to give you five insights to write down. If you're in a place where you can write on a tablet or a pad of paper or a phone, I believe Betty Robinson teaches us how grit grows. Five statements, and then we're going to pick apart a habitude. John mentioned habitudes in the introduction. Thank you, John. It's my favorite way to teach leadership and life principles, and it's through an image. I'm going to give you a brand new image today that's not even published. All right, so five insights that Betty Robinson teaches us about how grit grows. Number one, grit grows when necessity demands it. Again, grit grows when necessity demands it. Remember her as a young girl catching the train? It was a necessity. She didn't have a chance. She didn't have a car. She wasn't able to hitchhike or whatever. So when we place ourselves in situations like Betty, where just our daily or weekly routine requires it, we'll grow it. It's kind of like a muscle. You go to the gym and you start lifting weights, that necessity will build your muscle. Grit works like a muscle. So catching that train every day, whether she liked it or not, it was the necessity that built the grit. So can I just encourage you right off the bat? Can I be your one-hour coach today? Put yourself in situations where you have to have it, where you don't have any choice. Because if you have a choice, you're going to pick, let's watch TV, let's watch Netflix, let's eat Cheetos, you know? Just know we've got to put ourselves in situations where it demands it. Number two, grit grows when there's fierce competition. You remember Betty in the high school track team, which, by the way, was all boys. And I'm not saying boys are better than girls. I mean, my gosh, thank God for both genders. But hear me out. You know that very often through history, the boys would come in a little bit faster in races than females. So she was up against the other gender where she had fierce competition and was better. So that high school track team helped foster grit in a whole nother way. What if you and I put ourselves in situations where there was friendly competition, but it was the very competition that just pulled us up, kind of like when the tide goes up, all the boats go up? Where could you put yourself in a situation where you're against other really good, fast people and whatever you're trying to get good at, and you just allow that competition to do the work? Again, kind of like a fitness center. Number three, grit grows when there is huge aspiration. Betty began to set her sights on the 1928 Olympics as a teenager. Her coach planted that seed in her. So I don't need to say much. I believe that we're never going to really develop the grit we need unless we put in front of us a huge aspiration. And I don't know if that means building your own business and setting a clear goal in front of you, but aspiration usually produces inspiration. Aspiration usually produces inspiration to reach something. So put something in front of you. For Betty, it was the Olympics. What is it for you? Four, grit grows when adversity is introduced. I don't know about you, but the most striking thing from Betty Robinson's story for me was the plane crash. Who would have thunk it? Still as a young lady, she's in this plane crash that, I mean, not many people survive a plane crash. It's well, that sounds cliche, but may I tell you, I was in a plane crash when I was 30 years old, and I survived too. I don't know if I had any grit at the time, but it was a minor miracle that I made it through. I was in New Zealand. The plane went down. It was horrific. My ankle was hurt. My rib was hurt, and my head was hurt, but I survived. I believe since that time, I had a greater sense of urgency about my life. I realized how mortal I am, and I realized I've got to give it everything I got in light of that, because God spared me. So don't run from adversity. Run to it. Let it be that accountability partner or that, I don't know, that coach that just says, heart is good, heart is good, heart is good. All right, one last insight. I believe Betty Robinson teaches us that grit grows when we must adapt to new opportunity. So the grit muscle, if you will, grows even deeper and further and bigger when we have that adversity, and now the number one job of the hour is to adapt or adjust or flex, if you will. Remember, Betty comes out of that surgery or those multiple surgeries with a leg shorter than the other. So she couldn't do what she'd love to do, run the 100-meter race. She switched over and adapted to run a relay on the relay team and, of course, wins another gold medal. So very quickly, in a minute, five lessons Betty Robinson teaches us. Number one, grit grows when necessity demands it. Grit grows when there's fierce competition. Grit grows when there's huge aspiration. Grit grows when adversity is introduced. And grit grows when we must adapt to a new opportunity. Now, you know what, John? Let me stop for just a moment. I want to go to a habitude image that I think is going to help us retain all this. But before I do, let me just stop down. And you don't have to talk, everybody, but if you want to weigh in with a thought or a question or whatever, I want to give you a quick chance. Can we do something different, John, and just open it up right now, and then we'll close it back down, and I'll teach you a little bit.
Sure. Absolutely. There's already a couple of people in the queue, so let's see what they have to say.
Okay.
Hey,
first is Maria.
John, yes. Tim,
yes.
Don't like adversity.
Join the club.
I don't like adversity. I am an SC in my DISC personality. I like things to be quiet and normal and friendly and stuff like that. So I am seeing this hair, and now I understand that I grow in adversity, but it's not something I embrace. So I am seeing here that I need to probably go with an embracing, in other words, just looking differently at adversity without struggling, you know, so that I can grow my grit.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. In fact, I would say as an SC, you're going to have to be very intentional. You just use that word, I think, just choosing, because your normal subconscious is going to choose the steady and the compliant and the, you know, the orderly way. I understand that. I'm a creature of habit, and my habits are nice and friendly. And, you know, I'd like to sit on the sofa for a while and watch Netflix. The more intentional we can be, I have to be. So I want to just encourage what you said is spot on. Find yourself making some intentional decisions that will force you to do what you know you can do. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. All right. The next up would be JJ.
Hey, team. So nice to hear you again. The last time in our personal growth day, really enjoyed your keynote. And today, again, what a wonderful story of Betty Robinson and the 5 points. Well, since I'm on the speaker track, I actually take away a lot more from how you delivered this, and I really love it. How you opened the story, gave the 5 points, which immediately led to the note-taking moment. I grabbed my pen and going through the 5 points, you put in your personal story when it demands it, not on trying to like insert your story in every single point. It just flowed so well, and I really learned from this in terms of that. Thank you.
Well, good, JJ. Thank you. I'm learning to communicate, and my mentor, much like you, is John Maxwell. He seems to know how to get through, but isn't it fun? Stories just do it for us. Our brains think in stories. And so I have long walked by the little axiom, give them a point for their head, a picture for their heart, and a practice for their hands. A point for their head, here's the big idea. A picture for their heart, here's a story of how it looks. And then a practice for their hands, a step they can take. And that's what I was hoping to accomplish today. But thanks for picking up on that.
Great. So we've got a lot in the queue. How many would you like to go through here, Tim?
Let's do a couple of others. I really think, and then, John, we can go back to those if we want, but I don't want to get too distracted. This image is going to be so much fun. And, John, I think you're going to love it because you've already seen those habitudes. It's a brand new one. So let's do – you want to do one more, and then we'll
– Yeah.
Great.
We'll do that. Next up is Gene.
Man, this is great. Oh, my gosh. This is right up my alley, Tim. Thank you much for today. And just to review real quick, you said a point for their head, a picture for their heart, and what was the last one?
A practice for their hands, which means something to do. I think most people need that clarity. They get the story and they get inspired, but they go, but what do I do? You know. And if you notice, what I tried to do just then was say, what if you introduced adversity, you know, or whatever. So, yeah, those three seem to serve me well, and I think they'll probably serve you as well.
This is where I'm going. I'm actually, unfortunately, or however it can be fortunate, to a 9/11 family member, and so I have a model of my sister who did exactly this. She always cared for the homeless on the street and valued people and actually valued me raising me because I was 2 months old when my dad passed. And so she really modeled, the wow. And I'm actually put in a proposal to speak in Sacramento at my professional society in October. And I'm just hoping and praying I get a chance to repurpose my PowerPoint that I did. And that's part of what I want to share. You know, it's not the whole story. It's, you know, about how trees were healing, you know, for me and how I use that to use my passion and turn my passion into purpose. But this is great, because that's what I want to say. I want to say this is good. The point for their head is, she was not here because of that. Picture for their heart. Picture her bending down and talking to the homeless on the street. What practice can you do that is going to perpetuate that model, that's the message I want to get out there, because she modeled it for me, and I've been attempting, I will say attempting, to do what she did as best as I can. And grit, I've been through a few too many work injuries. I've had a lot of grit to take that through. But this has really been awesome. So I really want to thank you for being here. And if you have any thoughts on what or how else I can dive into this a little bit without, being too heavy, that would be great.
Okay. Yeah, I'll volley back. First of all, it sounds great. What a memorable nugget to take out to this this event that I'm hoping you get to speak to. I go back to the point for their head. Make sure as you sift through your brain and kind of distill what it is you want to say, that the point is a little bit like a principle, as much as possible. You know how John Maxwell always shares principles, the law, 21 laws of leadership, laws of teamwork, laws of communication. So if you can, make it a memorable statement. And by the way, when I get to this habitude coming up, you're going to hear me make a statement that you go, that's memorable. That was the point. So it sounds like you're on the right track. I'm not correcting you. I'm just saying, as much as you can, make sure the point for their head, they can grab hold of like a handle, and then the story just vividly illustrates it and inspires them, and then the application step is obvious. So, but it sounds like you're on the right track.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to hear the rest of your talk this morning. Really appreciate it.
Happy Easter, Jean.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Well,
all right.
Back to you, Tim.
Okay, John, thank you. So if you're not familiar with what habitudes are, eventually Maxwell Leadership is going to make these habitudes available as something you can get certified in. And I'm looking forward to that day. I can hardly wait to turn a bunch of you loose using imagery and metaphors to help people remember a principle. But the one I have today is on grit, which will not shock you, but it's a new one, and it's not been published yet. I simply call it the Diamond Secret. The Diamond Secret. Now, I don't have a screen behind me that you can see, but picture, if you will, a beautiful, sparkling diamond in the midst of a coal mine, okay? Most of us know enough about how diamonds are formed to know that they often come out of coal mines, okay? Maybe even in South Africa. But the part of the story that we've all heard is a myth. You might have seen one of the Superman movies where, he's in this coal mine and the coal is turning into diamonds. Coal actually does not turn into diamonds. But the carbon inside the coal is what actually turns into a diamond. And not all coal turns into diamonds. Otherwise, they wouldn't be so rare and expensive. So let me kind of give you the bottom line, kind of the truth in a nutshell, if you will, about diamonds and coal. So as I mentioned, coal has carbon inside of it that can remain unchanged for years, centuries, or it can undergo pressure and be turned into a beautiful diamond. The secret is what's inside that coal and how long it withstands the pressure. So it is with us. We can stay the same and let pressure simply become stress, or we can do something positive with the pressure and be transformed into a better version of ourselves. My guess is every one of you know people, and maybe that person is staring back at you in the mirror when you look in the mirror every morning, but that undergo a little pressure. They have a hard day, hard week, hard month, and the pressure merely turns into stress. In fact, we say things like, I'm stressed out. I'm stressed out. Don't we hear millions of people, it feels like, saying I'm stressed out? That is the mark of the day of our day. But listen to me. Coal and that carbon undergoes stress, call it pressure, and something wonderful happens with it. But it's the carbon that does something positive with the pressure that gets turned into the diamond. And that's what I'm suggesting for you. the takeaway I want you to get, there's actually a few takeaways, but here's one of the big ideas I want you to capture today, and I want you to hold on to it for the rest of your life. Pressure isn't the problem. It's the solution. Can I say that again? Pressure isn't the problem. It's the solution. I think we are conditioned by our wonderful smart technology, instant access, on-demand, instant gratification day we live in, to think that all pressure is bad. In fact, one of you even just mentioned, I think it was Marie, you just mentioned, I don't really like, you know, pressure and stress and you know, and things that I have to adapt to. It's normal. Human beings, our brains are actually hardwired to look for shortcuts. We want to conserve energy, particularly as we get older, and so we naturally do that. But I'm saying the best stories we hear from people are the ones that face some pressure, not the ones that sat on the couch all day. They face pressure, and they did something positive with it. And now there's this beautiful diamond, if you will. But it's the people that decided pressure isn't the problem. It's the solution. Pressure isn't my adversary. It's my ally. Now, a guy by the name of Dane Jensen a few years ago wrote a book called The Power of Pressure. And he says, after interviewing 1,000 people about pressurized moments that they went through, he says that all pressurized experiences, if you're taking notes, little headline here, all pressurized experiences include three elements. So I'm going to give you three items to jot down, okay? Number one, there's an element of importance. Just write the word down, importance. So the stakes feel high because the outcome is valuable. We don't really feel pressure if we have a little bit adversity, but we don't really care whether we do well or not. You know, it's that friendly game of ping pong or whatever. You know, it doesn't really matter. But when there's some event or experience that we would say, this is important to me, that's when we start feeling the pressure. The stakes are high and the outcome is valuable. Number two, another element of pressurized experiences is uncertainty. Isn't it true? The pressure feels bigger when there's an element of uncertainty. There's no guarantee of the outcome. It could go either way. We don't have somebody right next to us say, here's a bunch of cash in case you run out, or here's a warranty on that, or here's an insurance policy on that. We absolutely come alive when we're in uncertain situations, and there's that God-given energy inside us that says, I'm going to do this. All right, the third ingredient in all pressurized experiences is volume. So we feel like it's really true pressure when we have to process an intense amount of input. So go back to our imaginary fitness center. You lift 10 pounds, not that big of a deal. You lift 100 pounds, it's a bigger deal. 150 pounds, bigger deal. You get the point. So when there's an element of importance, it really feels valuable. An element of uncertainty, there's no guarantee. And an element of volume, I feel like a lot's coming at me. In fact, that's when usually we start feeling overwhelmed. I don't know if you know this, but the number one word that college students use to describe their life is the word overwhelmed. And they're just 18 to 22 years old. 94% of college students in America today say, I'm just overwhelmed. And almost half say, I'm so overwhelmed it's difficult to function. I don't believe life was supposed to be this way. I don't think that's how we're supposed to live our life. But because we don't really have a choice, it's the world we live in. What if every one of us on this call said, I'm going to turn it around. I'm going to become that carbon that's doing something positive with the pressure, and I just keep getting better and better. So bottom line, everybody, pressure either leads to stress or success. One of the two is going to happen. You're either going to get to the other side and just say, I'm stressed out, and every one of us on this call could say, I got stories, right? Or success. We go through, and it is stressful. I'm not saying it turns into easy, but I'm saying some of us are going to get to the other side of it and go, I just succeeded because of. Betty Robinson might say, I never would have become as fast as I became had I not had the competition and the plane crash and the train catching and all of this other stuff. So I want you to think about something for just a minute. I'm going to push pause just for you to think. I'm not going to have you talk yet. But think about this. Can you think of a time in your past when you experienced a lot of pressure? Okay? Just think for a minute. Can you recall one of those things one of those times when things turned out well? And can you think of one when they didn't turn out well? Let me just be quiet for just a moment. I'll rephrase it while you're thinking. Name a time in your past when you experienced a lot of pressure. Can you name a time when you faced it well and things turned out well? You turned out better for it. And can you name a time when you go, you know what, I didn't react very well to that, and I just never got really better. I just kind of buckled under the pressure. My guess is every one of us can think of an example of both of those, okay? All right. So I'm just asking to reflect here. Let's take the next few minutes before I stop to talk about how or what the secret is to making pressure work for you. I'm going to go a few more minutes, and then I'm going to open it up for discussion and questions, okay? So if you're taking notes, the secret to making pressure work for you, it's just two simple to understand ideas. Number one, what you see, and number two, what you do. So the people that make pressure work for them see something different than other people see about the pressure, and then they do something different with that pressure. So see and do, see and do, see and do, okay? All right, so let's look at both of those, and then I'm going to stop. Let's go back to number one I just gave you. Successful people see pressure as a push forward, okay? So I bet most of you can think of times in your career when you had some pressure and you had to perceive, okay, I'm going to rise to this occasion, and you were better at the end. I'll give you a couple from me. So some of you know enough about my story to know that I started working for John Maxwell 40 years ago this year. It was 1983. I was fairly much fresh out of college, green, wet behind the ears, didn't know much. And, oh, boy, thank God I got under a good leader who I didn't have to, who taught me well, and I didn't have to unlearn a lot of bad habits. But you can imagine serving under John Maxwell at 23 years old, there was a little pressure. You know, I mean, his standards for excellence were way higher than the last organization I had worked for. And I kind of set the standard where I was before. Now I had an older, wiser man setting the standards. I remember working with John Maxwell on the Maxwell Leadership Bible. And it was an amazing experience, but I had to see it as good pressure, not bad pressure. And I'll be honest with you, I had times working on that project with him that I didn't think I was up to it. It was just an overwhelming thing. I sat in my basement for 13 months. But let me tell you something. The fact that he believed I could do it made me think I could do it because I respected his opinion more than my opinion. So it always helps to get somebody we respect say, you can do this. You got it. And then starting growing leaders. I started a nonprofit 20 years ago this year. And I did not quite know if we were going to put food on the table. You've been there before, haven't you? And I had to leverage that pressure as a push forward. So successful people see pressure as a push forward. Let me give you an analogy real quick before I do number two. I want you to imagine yourself. This is kind of crazy, so just go with me on this zany journey, okay? Picture yourself at an amusement park, okay? Maybe it's a theme park. Maybe it's Disney, okay? You're at a theme park. It's really crowded. You're in a long line to ride on a ride, and some teenagers behind you kind of start just having fun, but they're rustling and, you know, they're kind of bickering back and forth and kind of punching each other just a little bit, and they accidentally knock you over. Well, when you get knocked over, it feels intrusive, right? I mean, you feel you've been violated. But what if when you get back up, your first attempt is to scold those teens, but when you get back up, what if you notice you got back up and you've been pushed to the front of the line? I know this is crazy, but just go with me on it, okay? Let's say you get pushed. You're now right behind the person who's getting on the ride next. What was once feeling very intrusive suddenly feels like, woo, I'm glad that happened. Nobody seems to notice, but the push pushed me forward. That's what I'm saying. What if we could see pressure as a push forward in the line? I'm telling you, this has served me well. When I felt, you know, those projects I just listed, when I saw it as push forward, I was much better. All right, enough said. The second big idea that I just shared before is successful people believe that they possess the power to do something about the situation. So think with me for just a minute. if you see pressure coming and you start feeling stressed, which is very normal, and you believe you can't really do anything about it, that stress is just going to become distress. You're just going to be distressed. But if you see the stress and the pressure and you see, you know what? I'm going to do something with this. I'm going to do something positive in response to the stress. It's kind of like when you go to a doctor's appointment. If the doctor gives you medication for something and she or he says later, ooh, your body's responding to the treatment. That's a positive word, isn't it? When you're responding. If you say, oh, your body's reacted, that's a negative. So don't react, respond. That's going to be the key. So let me give you an example. For me, stress is yelling at the television when your favorite team is playing a game, right? Let me tell you why it's stress. No matter how much you yell, you cannot change the outcome of that game by yelling. True? You're sitting on the sofa, you're eating your Cheetos, and you're yelling, and it feels good, but you can't change anything. You know what pressure is? Pressure is actually playing in that game. So even though it feels hard, at least you can do something about it. You're in the game. You're not watching the game. So I would say for some of you, maybe the key right now is get back in the game. You're watching a little bit. You're a little bit afraid, maybe. I don't know. Maybe a little apprehensive. I'm saying, my gosh, this is so key. So let me give you a good example of this. On our Growing Leaders team, I have some really fun people to work with. I am very, very fortunate. But Mimi is one of the gals that works on our team. Mimi is a quiet giant. She is a wonderful teammate. You can always count on her, right? She's always dependable. But Mimi, about 10 years ago, she's 32, she used to play on Georgia Tech's women's basketball team. And by the way, she's really good. She's so good that her freshman year, she started. And she played all 4 years as point guard for Georgia Tech. That's how good she is. But she and I talked about this diamond secret recently. And she laughed, and she said this to me. Do you know what? I can tell you what stress is. I can tell you what pressure is. She said, when I got taken out of the game to rest a little bit, I felt stress because I'm yelling from the bench, but I can't do a cotton picking thing about that game. I want to be put in the game. Even though I may not be the best player on the court, at least I can do something. That's what I'm saying. We need to wish to be put in the game. We're Michael Jordan who says, put me in, coach. Put me in. I want to shoot that last shot. I'm not claiming I'm the best in the world. I'm just saying I got to do something positive with this. Okay, so quick quote by James Clear. In the gym, if you experience no stimulus, your muscles aren't going to grow. If you step under 10,000 pounds, your body's going to break. Life is similar. Too much challenge makes life hard, but so does too little. We become the best version of us with pressure. If I can be your pastor for a minute, that's how God made us. It's how he made us. Now we need to lean on him, but I'm telling you folks, we need it, we need it, we need it. So real quick, a rat-a-tat-tat list of action steps. Remember, point for your head, picture for your heart, practice. Here's some practice for your hands. One, I'd like to first suggest that you embrace a realistic view of what's really at stake. Sometimes I think we make mountains out of molehills. Part of our stress is we make way too much about something that shouldn't be too much. So get a realistic view of the challenge that's in front of you. It's not going to be the end of the world if you finish a day later, but you do want to do it well. Two, focus on what you can control, not on what you can't control. Okay? Everything in life sits in one of three buckets. It is in your control, it's out of your control, or it's within your influence. But two out of three are those something you can do about. It's in your control or within your influence. So make sure you're controlling the controllables and just trust the process for the other stuff. Three, eliminate sources of stress that distract you. So most of you on this call would probably say, Tim, I got 12 sources of stress right now. It's my kids. It's my job. It's this. It's that. It's the other. It's the bills that are coming due this month. Eliminate whatever you can that just doesn't need to be there. Isn't it true sometimes we create more problems for ourselves because we're stressing out over everything at once? Don't do that. Get rid of anything you can. What's the phrase we've all come to know? How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Four, determine one step you can take towards your goal. So remember that aspiration that I talked about setting in front of you? Don't try to take 17 steps today. Take one step. Progress is what's key. My wife can tell when I've had a great day. It's when I've had a day and I took one step of progress. If I have regress or no-gress, if you will, I don't have a good day. So progress is my favorite word. 5, envision positive outcomes that could come from that pressure. So I'm sure that Betty Robinson saw herself winning the gold when she was on that relay team. She'd already done it once. She knew what it felt like. She knew what it looked like to stand on the podium with a gold medal around her neck as a teenager. So see it before you see it, all right? See it on the inside before you see it on the outside. Next, talk about people who benefited from PTG. Now, I know you're probably, well, I don't know if you're probably, you may be thinking, what's PTG? Just write it down by faith. I'm going to explain it to you. When we go through pressure and it becomes trauma, right? We've all heard the term PTSD, right? Post-traumatic stress disorder. I think a lot of us think naturally we're going to have PTSD to a degree if we go through any level of trauma. And we might. But did you know 4 out of 5 people that go through trauma actually end up with PTG? That's an actual psychological diagnosis. PTG is not post-traumatic stress disorder. It's post-traumatic growth. Yeah. So when you go through some trauma, call it the pressure and your carbon, okay? If you have someone next to you that guides your thinking to draw the right perspective when it's done, meaning you can see the silver lining in the dark cloud, and maybe you don't need another person. Maybe you just learn to train your own thinking, your own perspective. If you can see the good that can come from bad, that's post-traumatic growth. And I'm telling you, it's like going to a weight room and lifting a heavy weight. All right, the last statement I want to make before we do some questions is clarify why the outcome is important to you. Clarify why the outcome is important to you. Let me tell you why I put this last. This has been my best friend. Whenever I'm in the middle of a very hard project and I kind of lose sight of my why, and I'm now thinking, you know what, maybe I'll just quit. You know, I choose quit over grit. If I remind myself why I want to reach this goal, why this is so cool for my marriage or my children or my job or this book I'm working on, when I get back to the why, I suddenly get new energy. So we turn the energy around when we do that. It's kind of like seeing the good instead of the bad. So think about this. When you are facing a lot of pressure, let's say you're a lump of coal with some carbon inside and you're feeling the pressure. Instead of saying, I feel nervous, which I think many of us are prone to say, what if you said, I feel excited? It's the same energy. It's just directed toward a positive angle instead of negative. Nervousness and excited are both the very same energy. One's directed to the dark side, one's to the bright side. I have found myself. I'll tell you what. Somebody mentioned before getting on the stage at IMC last month. I don't know if you weren't there. Let me tell you what happened. I was supposed to interview Coach Sean McDermott, the head coach for the Buffalo Bills. He was going to be the star, the last speaker that day. Well, Sean's dad gets taken to he gets taken to the hospital that very day. He is in trouble. And Sean realized he's got to get back home. And we all said, you need to get back home. You just go. And Mark Cole stepped up and said, folks, I know you'll understand. You won't like it, but you'll understand. Sean's been called back home. Well, guess who got on the platform? I think I had maybe an hour and a half or whatever to get ready when we knew. But John Maxwell and Mark Cole looked at me and said, I want you to go on. Well, let me tell you something. I felt a little nervous because, number one, they're expecting Sean McDermott, not me. So their expectations are going to be dashed, you know, that sort of thing. But I'm also thinking, how will I rise to this occasion in 90 minutes? I mean, what I said to myself backstage? I feel excited. Now, it was nervousness, but I'm excited. I can hardly wait to say this. I think it's going to be relevant and helpful. And I don't know if it was, but I heard several people say, that was exactly what I needed. So you know how this feels. You've all been in that situation, and that's where I'm going to stop. Never underestimate the power of action, and never underestimate the power of how you perceive the pressure. Okay, John, I'm done. I'm going to stop, and I'm going to turn it back over to you to kind of field the questions, and we'll go on.
Well, you know, I'm selfishly going to tell you, I love this, and I was going to ask you, I'm sure you've seen that analogy or that YouTube video of the rabbi talking about the lobster under pressure and having to get a new shell. I mean, that's what kept coming to mind through all of that. So, Tim, I appreciate that. I'm going to go to our next person in the queue, but thank you so much for sharing all of that.
All right.
It is Dory. Dory, you're up with Tim.
Thank you. Good morning. Oh, my gosh.
Good morning.
Tim, you are fabulous. First of all, thank you for stepping up to the plate at IMC. I thought it was great, and I love the eight paradoxes. It's one of my favorites. I'm a loving grit topic. I'm a grit girl. But I'm thinking one of the most difficult is this grit grows when there's fierce competition. And I'm seeing more so now with teams. I work with a lot of teams. And it seems more so now they kind of like go under the rock when there's fierce competition. And I've been trying to work a lot on bringing them out of the rock and, you know, putting them in that diamond. So a lot of what you said I'm going to formulate for them. But anything else that just pops in your head for that?
Yeah.
You know, we give them hope and belief on you can do it. Yes, we believe in you, you got to believe in yourself.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. And that's, of course, what you want to instill in them, where they don't require someone like you. I'm glad you're there. But they're going to grow older and become an adult one day, and they're going to have to do this on their own. I don't know if this is rocket science or not, Dory, but what I often do when I'm in front of teams, and I too work with a lot of young people, I will, at some point during our time together, say, imagine the day or a day when you do become the best version of yourself. And then I might let them think a little bit, but I'll do what I just did with you all just a minute ago. If you're sitting on the couch all day long eating Fritos or Cheetos and watching soap operas on TV all day, you're laughing right now, aren't you? They're automatically going to see, I'm not becoming a really great person right then. You know, I'm loving it. It's easy. I can be lazy. But, paint that picture and even say, when are the days you become the best person? And when you pose that as one side of the equation, they're not dumb. They're going to see, that's not it. And you're actually leading their thinking to say, I guess I do kind of need pressure. I'm a little bit like the carbon. I actually do get better if I respond well. So that's one thing, and I'm sure you're going to do that naturally. But you know what? The other thing I would say is tell those stories. I don't know if Betty Robinson's the right one or a story from your own life, but they need stories of people that came out of nowhere. One of my favorites, and I may have even shared it on one of these calls before, is about 100 years ago, two young men got polio at the same time. And back then, 100 years ago, polio was a deadly disease. You know that. I remember my mom and dad said it was like a killer in my day back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. But one young man just responded quite humanly and naturally. He just buckled under the pressure. He had polio. He wouldn't get to do many of the things that young men his age got to do. He became bitter over the whole thing instead of better. You know, I would venture to guess if I said his name, you would have never heard of him. The other young man was a guy named Franklin D. Roosevelt, who decided as a young man, actually, I want to go into civil service. I want to, go into politics. maybe this will help me identify with those who have had similar, you know, tragedies. And boy, was that helpful during the Great Depression, World War II. So he actually leveraged that. Now, you can tell that story however you want, but I think the teens will say, oh, yeah, I'd never thought of it that way. He used the very thing that caused the other guy to buckle to push him forward. He got better instead of bitter. So and anyway, I'm saying what you already know. I would just say, yeah, give him those stories and see what happens.
Love it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you, Dory. Great
Thank
question.
You.
All right. Next up is Ed. You're on with Tim.
Hey, Tim. So my question is just with you. I've read your last book, and I was just wondering, is that, I work with a lot of 20 and 30-year-old work. Is that something that can help, you know, deal with this? You know, you mentioned earlier being overwhelmed.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, one of my roles, the 50-year-old, is to just kind of help guide through that it's not the end of the world. Get through this.
Yeah.
I'm just interested in the habitudes. I haven't got into that yet. Is that good for the 20 and 30-year-old set in the work world?
Absolutely. I may be biased, in fact, I'm sure I'm biased, but I have found that young people have just grown up on screens, and images or metaphors are the language that gets through. I mean, I would even say at my age, that's what I remember is images and stories and metaphors. So absolutely. In fact, can I give you a bonus one right now that might be helpful? One of our images in the book Habitudes for the Journey is called Toll Booths or Roadblocks. And it's kind of a very similar theme. When we come up to a roadblock as we're driving a car, we come up to that, you know, that little fence that's painted white and orange, you know, the diagonal white and orange paint, and we come up to the roadblock, we really don't have any options. It's a roadblock. In fact, the only thing we can really do is back up and go the other direction. Toll booths are different. In the same way, we do have to stop. But with a toll booth, we pay a price, and we keep moving forward. So everybody gets stuck at some point, especially 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds, like you just said. But I think we say to them, you get to choose whether it's a roadblock or a toll booth. And as I have gone through challenges, type 1 diabetes and the plane crash I talked about or the car crashes I've been in or whatever, I make a choice. This is going to be a toll booth. I'm going to pay a price. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to pay a price. So whether it's injuries on a sports field or a bad grade on a test or a challenge from my supervisor or whatever, I think we got to choose to see it. Once again, it's how we see it. That's going to be coming back. So the answer is yes, I think it could be helpful, and feel free to use this. Some one day we're going to make this certified material, and as Maxwell folks, you can grab it and hang a shingle out and use it, but without the image or the slide deck right now, feel free to use what I've shared.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Ed. Thanks for calling in. All right. Up next is Diane. You're on.
Good morning. Oh, my God, Tim. This is wonderful. Every time I hear you, it just gets better and better. Thank you so much. This message this morning. Now,
great,
Tim,
thanks.
Now, is this grit something that's born in you, that, or can you develop it? Or because, you know, you said some people move forward, others don't. So is it something that's born in us or what?
Great question. I think the right answer from a psychological standpoint is some temperaments or personalities do have a greater predisposition toward grit than others, right? If you're a mom or even an aunt or an uncle, you look at some kids and they just seem to be better at it than others, and you go, why can't you be like Bernie, you know, or whatever. So I do think there's a little bit inborn, but here's something that I'll share with you that's fascinating to me. There are two psychological terms that are used in regard to grit. One term is called learned helplessness, And the other is a term called learned industriousness. So if you're taking notes, let me give these again. Learned helplessness. It's a term that Marty Seligman came up with years ago. You don't need to remember that name, but here's the idea. He learned Okay, then you know this then. So he discovered, and it was, I think it was first with young people, but then it was with any people, when you try to attempt a challenge, and you try and you try and you try and you see no measurable progress at all, your brain learns to be helpless. You know, isn't it true? You try to open that peanut butter jar as a seven-year-old little kid, and you can't do it, you can't do it, you can't do it. You finally, Dad, Mom, you know, can you, because your brain tells you, you can't do this. Mm-hmm. Learned industriousness is when your brain tries and tries and tries, and you see even a remote but tangible step of progress, your brain says, keep going, it's getting better, keep going, it's getting better. So I'll tell you a fun John Maxwell story. John and I were talking about this years and years and years ago, and I brought up this term, learned helplessness, and he goes, Tim, that reminds me of my childhood. And I said, tell me a story. He said, well, when I was growing up, my brother Larry and I would wrestle in the living room after dinner. You know, just two boys, middle school, whatever, that would just get on the carpet and just wrestle. And John said, Tim, because Larry was older and a little bit bigger than me, he would always win. And pretty soon, he would win more quickly, and he would pin me to the ground. You can see what's happening here, you know? And John said he'd win faster and faster and faster because it was learned helplessness. Well, John said, Tim, I found my dad watching us at night, just after dinner, you know, just watching his sons. And one day, his dad, Melvin, told Larry, he said, Larry, let me have a shot at John. Let me see if I can beat him, too. And so Larry gets up and says, okay, Dad, and Larry gets, or excuse me, Melvin, the dad, gets down on the carpet, and you know what he's going to do. He wrestles his son, John, and John's only, I don't know what he's, you know, 11, 12 years old, but Melvin makes John work for it, but he lets John pin him to the ground. He said, John said, I got it with a big grin on my face. I just beat my dad. And John said, even though Larry did beat me more and more, he said, he never again pinned me to the ground because I had a picture in my head, I can do this. So I would say that concept, even though some temperaments are more inborn with grit, I think we can all learn one or the other. And our job as we work with either adults or kids is show them a little progress. I'll give you, I'm sorry, one more example. I just mentioned that peanut butter jar randomly just a minute ago. When my son Jonathan... When my son Jonathan was in elementary school, I don't remember how old he was, but he was young. We'd have peanut butter. We'd have peanut butter toast in the morning. I loved it, and so he learned to love it. So I would have him open the peanut butter jar, and I remember a time when he had tried and tried and tried, and he told me, "Dad, I can't get it. I need you to get it." Well, two things were working for him. One, he knew Dad could get it, so he always defaulted to somebody else do it for me. But two, he had learned helplessness. So one day I said, Jonathan, would you go get your mother? I want to ask her a question. And when Jonathan ran and got his mom, my wife, I had a time to loosen that jar lid just enough. I mean, it was still on there tight, but I knew he could do it. When he came back in, I said, hey, Jonathan, give this one more shot. Dad, I already tried and I can't do it. Just give it one more try. And if you can't do it, I'll do it. But I think you can do it. I give it one more try. Well, you know what happened? He tried and tried, and he got it. From that point on, every single time, he got it. But it, because his brain told him, you can do this. You got to keep trying. So I think that's the key. And I don't want to oversimplify, but I really think there's something there to teaching learned industriousness.
So is it like a mindset? You have to change your mindset? Is that what it is?
Yes. To learn? Absolutely. Yeah. You have to go from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Oh, this is wonderful. Now I have a question. Where can I find this? Is this on the underneath the business building so I can replay it, this message this morning?
John?
I believe the... Yeah, I believe, Diane, it's going to be under the thought leaders, but I'll tell you what, I will check that real quick because I thought our thought leaders had their own, but it will definitely be under the mentorship tab. I'll look that up while Tim goes to another question, and whenever he answers that, I'll have your answer and I'll chime back in. How about that?
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Tim.
Yes, my pleasure.
Thank you, Diane.
My pleasure.
All right. Up next, Denise Miller.
Hello. How are you both?
Doing
great.
That's good. Tim, this was absolutely wonderful. I just don't know where to put myself. It was wonderful. I was actually going to ask you about keeping momentum as an ID. Because I'm a very high I and a pretty high D, and sometimes they switch. And sometimes keeping momentum, it can be the I side of me gets discouraged, but the D side of me is like a sword with a bone. Okay, I just won't give I think, though, you answered a lot of what I was going to ask you with the 7 points that you gave us at the end. And I'm an acronym girl. And you gave us 7 points, and the word diamond has 7 letters. And so I'm going to try to put this, I think in those kinds of terms. And so I'm actually, as you're talking, I'm going through trying to find what words fit into, diamond to fit these 7 points in.
Yeah.
And I love it. I will let you know when I figure it out. How's that?
I would love that.
and I'll tell you, because I will figure it out, because I'm like a dog with a
bone. I'm sure you will.
That's
great.
And I'd like to know, would you be okay with me using that that acronym? I mean, I'm going to figure it out anyway, whether or not something that I could use or not, because I can just see this. You just have no idea what dances around in my head. I'm like, oh my goodness, I see PowerPoints, I see pictures, I see everything. So, but this, the teaching was amazing. It was, as always, just what the doctor ordered for me personally, all that you had to say about grit. And I was a college professor for 18 years before I came into the Maxwell team. And, so much of what you say about the lack of grit in young people is so true. It's part of the reason that I think I'm no longer teaching, because if one more student stepped into my office and told me that they needed the A, I was going to be teaching college from the inside of prison. Because it's like, you're a grown-up, step up.
Yep.
You know, that's something. Yep. Mantra, but it looks like I'm being pulled back into that realm again, and I'm not sure yet, and I'm like, oh my goodness, how am I going to handle this? But this was so on point for me to help me for myself, as well as to understand a little bit better how to handle the lack of grit that I have seen happen over the last 20 years. So thank you.
Yeah. Oh, you're welcome, and I'm so glad you're getting back in the game with young adults, with students. They represent our future, and what we need is a lot of gritty young professionals entering the workforce and our communities and families, knowing how to do life when it's hard, because it is. It's hard. There's no doubt about it. So glad you're in the game.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. I love working with them. I just really felt that I couldn't do it in a college setting anymore. So my business is kind of geared toward young professionals. And going into the marketplace, especially women. All of them, but particularly women, because I lived in that basket for 22 years before I started teaching. So, thank you.
Well, thank you, Denise.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks so much. All right. I think it was Diane who was asking, it's the Leadership Content Partners Call Library. It's under the mentorship tab. where the mentorship call library is. So it's the Leadership Content Partners Call Library. That's where you'll find the recording. Okay. Next up, we have Amy Nelson. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Great teaching, as everybody said. I wrote copious notes. I have just finished your Habitudes course, which was amazing. You have an amazing team for facilitating. Yeah. I realized afterwards I can't use it at this time, but I'm so excited for when you have that, because your teachings are so poignant. And I listened to the podcast. Like Denise, I thought I was going to be working with adults, and I see the need so much. And even with my own kids, I dealt with a lot of things that built grit and adversity, and had my own adult children now come back and say, you know, Mom, if we hadn't had that, we would never have made it to where we are today.
Wow.
And, you know, so I just want to thank you for your lesson, your message, and for all you do with us with John Maxwell Teaching. Look forward to using the materials in the future.
Good. Thank you. You just made my day. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you, Amy. Take care. All right. Up next will be Jose. You're on.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Tim, I've been on our last call, you gave me the advice of going through and studying What to Do Next by Jeff Henderson. So I'm studying it and I've come up with some decisions that I need to make. But what do you do as far as your career goes, when you narrow it down to two things, either you want to do one of the two things, what do you do?
Wow, that's a big question. I don't know if this is the best answer, but this is the first thing that comes to my mind. I would be prone, depending on what the two things are, to maybe find a way to try my hand a little bit at each and see if there's a sense of, this is it, you know? And it may be you can't, but like, let's say you're experimenting with this industry and then that industry. Maybe I try one, you know, as a paycheck, I don't know, and then one maybe on the side or vice versa. But I feel like experience becomes a wonderful teacher, because we have a sense of, this feels right, or the opposite. These are not my people. You know, this is not my deal. So, John, I don't know if you want to jump in with some wisdom, but if there's a way you could experience both or taste it, it might tell you what you need to know.
Yeah, actually, yeah. There is. Go ahead, John.
Oh, no, you can go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was going to say that, yes, there actually is a way for me to
experiment,
like an internship or part-time, or even try it out for free, like on-the-job training, to where I could see if that's what I want to do. But, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. I can do that on both of those. I really can. Yeah, I sure can. Thank you.
The only thing, John, that I would have you consider on that is, naturally, they've come down to two choices. And I think you remember I've said before, I always ask people, what feeds your soul and what feeds your bank account, and how can you make them as close as possible? And the question of what feeds your soul, what is it about each of those that is really soul-feeding to you? And that will, I think, along the way, even as you're trying them out, the way Tim said, is to be able to take note of, is this something I could do, you know, with endless energy, so that you don't find yourself down the road burned out? That's my only two cents.
Yeah, make sure that it's something that continually gives me energy and renews my energy.
Right on.
Fantastic.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate
you calling
in. Thank you.
All right. Up next is Marcus. I don't know how to say the other name that's on there.
Hi, it's Eliane. How are you?
Oh, Welcome.
Can you hear me?
Sorry. Yes.
I know my name is a little bit hard to pronounce. Tim, the talk today was very beautiful, and I'm very happy that you mentioned the IMC because you were there for a reason. And I'm looking at my notes, and my question is, I have a talk coming up in 2 weeks, and I just realized that it's going to be around 200 interpreters will be listening to this talk. I am an interpreter, and I will be training interpreters on what I titled my talk is how you secure your oxygen mask first before assisting others. Those interpreters are going to be interpreters in the immigration court, meaning they are going to be interpreting for respondents who are asking for asylum in the United States or for visa or a stay green card in the United States. And they are interpreting stories that they themselves lived. So I've been in that situation. I am a war survivor, and I interpreted for a lady who was coming from a country similar to my country. And in the middle of the testimony, I felt that I'm choking. So I did some research on how to relax the tension in our vocal cords so that I won't have strep throat after I interpret. And now I am stuck on how to relax and what should I, if you can give me some resources about stress relief when they are under the pressure. And I loved when you talk about PTSD versus PTG because so many of us immigrants, especially interpreters, we have some PTSD that wakes up after we hear other defendants' stories or their background because we share the same background. So I was going towards more technique, not to go and grab your first bottle of beer after you finish a hard assignment, how not to crave alcohol because many of us will automatically just crave something to unwind. We binge eat or we open a bottle of wine after we've heard and interpreted so many. I feel like I'm taking too much time. But what are the techniques that you can give for stress after, or how to relax after work stress and when stories are coming up, the monsters of the trauma you lived will come up. Is there anything you can give me that I can research and include in my talk?
Well, I don't know if I have anything brilliant or anything that you might not already have, but let me throw out a couple of thoughts. When I'm in those kinds of situations where it's just a nonstop, I got to go, I'm on. What I try to make sure I insert, even if it's just moments, not hours, is getting aside, closing my eyes, and breathing. Some people today would call this mindfulness, you know, where you just stop getting caught up in the flurry of thoughts that you're interpreting, but you just stop, get away a little bit if you can for a moment. I mean, you know, in your industry, your career, a lot of times interpreters will, you know, take turns because they do need a break. But if you can't get the break, I would say take those micro breaks and just breathing and focusing. One of our habitudes is actually called the starving baker. And the starving baker is the baker that spends so much time baking bread for others. He forgets or she forgets to eat and starves himself. So another step that I take is I want to make sure that even if it's just a couple of minutes, I'm feeding myself a thought or two to stay in the game. So let me share one more thought. I don't know if this is good. Feel free to eat the fish and spit out the bones here. Another habitude that we have is called emotional fuel. And that's just the people that you need around you. Sometimes we're in a grueling day, like interpreting for people all day long. What we need are people that are not sapping us, but people that are filling our tank. And emotional fuel basically teaches us that
unless we have inserted intentionally people in our life that fill our tank instead of drain our tank, we're going to run out. So I don't know if that's at the end of the day. You make sure you're getting on a call or sitting down with a person and just refilling your tank, because you know they're a filler, not a drainer. They're a fountain, yes, not a drain, if you know what I mean. I think those are key. I'm sure you know those. Those aren't rocket science, but those kinds are just fundamentals that I think we got to practice in our lives.
And one more question. For me, I'm Christian. I am a strong believer, and I do meditation. I do my journaling. I do my prayers. How am I going to share this with interpreters? 200, some of them are from totally different religions. So when I don't want to blind them with my faith, but at the same time, I want them to go back to their faith and think that maybe it is good to meditate.
I would say what I do has worked really well. When I get to that point in my talk, I'll just say, now, for many of you, you might say your faith plays a role in your journey of recovery or, you know, peace. And then you could say, that's certainly true for me. And then you might say, if you feel it's a little bit iffy, you might say, now, I'm not imposing this on anybody, but let me tell you what I do that really helps. And all you're doing is adding value. You're not evangelizing. You're just, you know, saying blah, 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 blah. So I feel like that's always been welcome. I'm mostly in public-facing arenas when I speak, meaning they're not Christian. They're, you know, it's a public school, a company. And I feel like nobody is angry or upset with me if I just say, I tell you what works for me. This may work for you as well. You know, and then I let it alone. And they get to make the call, not I'm exposing, not imposing. That's what I'm saying. That's the key. Learn to expose, not impose. And then I think you're going to be fine.
Okay. Learn to expose, not to impose. Thank you so, so much. That was great. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Right. Thank you so much. And up next, Diane, if you, either you dropped or I clicked too many times. So Diane, feel free to hit *61. And anyone else, *61, we're at the end of the queue, but Diane, if you'll hit it, I'll give you a second. If not, we'll close out the call. Sometimes, Kim, I'll get here and I'll get click happy on hitting next question, and it'll kick them out of the queue. So, oh, good. There she is. She's back. All right, Diane, you're up, and I apologize for that.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello? Oh, okay.
Yes.
Thank you, John. I did get the information where I can find this talk. But I have a quick question for you, Tim. I heard some of the other callers talk about your book, I need the exact title, and your podcast and course.
Yes. And what's your question? I'm sorry.
My question is the name of your book. Something with habits or something.
Yes.
I didn't quite catch it. And then your podcast, one of them talked about, and the course, one of them spoke of. Can you give me the names of those?
I'll be happy to. So the word that you were trying to remember was habitudes. It's a combination of habits and attitudes, So we say habitudes are images that form leadership habits and attitudes. So if you just typed in that word, well, I'll tell you what the website that has them, it's growingleaders.com. We're now a subsidiary of the Maxwell World, so growingleaders.com. You can find all 9 habitude books, and then we have a digital course that you can get. We designed it mostly for schools because we're hoping that young people learn these. The podcast is called Leading the Next Generation with Tim Elmore, and it's a twice-a-month podcast. Leading the Next Generation with Tim Elmore. And then the event, the event that we have is a Train the Trainer event, and it's called the Next Generation Facilitator Certification, NGFC, Next Generation Facilitator Certification. And what it does is we basically, in this 2-day event, certify you to go back to whatever your organization is and teach Habitudes, and to teach them effectively, how to leverage an image to teach a point. It doesn't allow you yet to hang a shingle out and go sell it, but that's coming. Mark Cole and I are in dialogue right now on how do we make this where we can certify you, and then you can actually use it as part of your business. I'm hoping that happens within the next year. But that's where you can find us now, growingleaders.com, and that's where the events and books are. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tim, and thank you so much, John.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Diane. All right. We have a couple more in the queue. And is this Cal?
Yes, sir, it is.
There you go. You're
great.
On.
Great. My question well, it's partially answered in the last caller. To piggyback on or continue on with that question, can the books be found at a Barnes & Noble's or bought on Amazon?
Yes, they can be bought on Amazon. They may or may not be in a Barnes & Noble. We publish those at Growing Leaders. And the reason I did that is because when you go with a trade, I've actually had several trade publishers ask, could we publish these? But you lose control over the various things you might want to do with them. Anyway, they're at growingleaders.com, and you can find used copies on Amazon. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Simple enough. Probably the easiest question of the day.
It probably was, yeah.
All right. Thank you, Cal.
My pleasure.
And actually, I highly recommend those books for anyone. I think I've only been through three of them, and I didn't even realize there were nine. So I've got six more to go. My goodness.
That's right, John.
All right. So we have Deli. You're up next.
Hey, John. Hi, team. Good to be back. I've been away from those calls for about a year now. Slowly working my way back up again. I'd like to pick your brain, both of you, if you could help me with an idea. I've been invited to have a keynote at a district conference of a Rotary in Poland, and it's already in a couple of weeks from now. Usually I would speak on my regular topic, which is polio, as you mentioned, Tim. I'm a polio fundraiser. Okay. But this time, they actually went through my CV and realized that I'm a leadership trainer, so they want me to talk about leadership. So we couldn't really nail it down to what is it exactly they want me to talk about. So he came up with a title that says, and they already published it, The Role of Leadership in Managing or Solving Important Questions. So I'm thinking I have 20 minutes. I can maybe negotiate myself up to 30 minutes, which probably 5 or 10 minutes of it I'll have to create rapport and establish myself as a speaker or as a leadership trainer, and I have very, very little time to really talk into such a big topic like managing or solving important questions. So thinking about maybe finding the three most attractive that has all three P's, that giving them a point, giving them a picture, and then maybe giving them a practice. Do you think I can squeeze two or three of them in 15 minutes? And if yes, do you have any, giveaways for me? It's a big question, but I'm trying to pick your both brains, both John and Tim.
Yeah, sure. John, do you want to lead off?
You know, Deli, as I was listening to you, I love Tim's analogy on, you know, the point and the picture and the practice, and that's actually one of my takeaways from this, by the way, is for me to go ensure that I'm kind of in that type of structure. I love that, it's the simplicity of it. But the thing that came to mind when you were talking about, the role of the manager or in solving important questions, it got me thinking more about, you know, leadership is asking good questions. You know, we've got somebody who wrote Good Leaders Ask Great Questions. So it's not about solving questions as much as it is leading the team through asking good questions. But that was the first thing, and so I'm noodling right now or marinating on your question a little bit more, but that was the initial thought that came to my mind.
So I had the same idea, only I called it coaching, but obviously it's the same with Good Leaders Ask Great Questions.
Mm-hmm.
instead of telling them what to do, asking questions. So that's actually one of the points I wanted to incorporate. So thank you for reconfirming that for me.
Right on.
Any other ideas? The role of leadership in solving important questions.
Yeah. I remember John Maxwell taught me when I was in my 20s, the fastest way to gain leadership is to solve problems. So even though he didn't use the word questions, it's true. If you have the right question to ask, the right wisdom to offer to a big question, you're going to gain influence. It could be that you camp out on that. But I love what John just said. I think posing the right question is huge. Have you all heard the quote before? A person that shares the right answers, you know, is smart. The person that asks the right questions, you know, is wise. And I do think there's a bit of a difference between wisdom and smarts. Smarts can be gained by just reading, but wisdom usually comes with experience. One thing I will just encourage you is this. The shorter your talk, the harder it will be to prepare.
That's why I'm trying to get 10 more minutes.
That's right. Exactly. You know it, don't you? It'd be easier to talk an hour. You could say everything.
I can
it's
talk
so
for 2 days on leadership. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Mark Twain once said, I only have 20 minutes. I don't have enough time to get ready for 20 minutes. Yeah.
Exactly.
So here's what I would do. If I were you, I would really do some thinking and maybe come up with a metaphor that will be an anchor for your big ideas. Because you could always go back to that picture, just like I did today with the diamond secret. Come up with a metaphor, an analogy, that you'll go back to and go back to and back to. And no matter what your 20 or 30 minutes you say, you're going to go back to that anchor, and that becomes the big point.
Yeah, I'm thinking that coaching would be my anchor, that all the people
would come
back to coaching again. Yeah, because it's the first time I'm giving a speech where I can actually establish myself as somebody they can work with later on, because all my speeches for the last 10 years I've done in Rotary were based on just fundraising for polio. And this time I'm like, why not just establish myself as somebody they can work with later on?
Yeah. Well, I think you're on the right track. I really do. I hope that goes well.
Thank you. I will pick up the brains of a couple of more mentors, and by the end of these 2 weeks, I'll probably
right
have my 3 points. Thank you for your time.
You're a
thank
smart
you for
lady.
A great teaching.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you, Deli. It's great
thank
to hear
you,
your
John.
Voice again. Okay, Denise, you're up again.
Yes, I'm back. I was so busy concentrating on the acronym that I missed, Tim, when you spoke about what you see and what you do. I got the points for what you see, the secret to handling pressure successfully, but did you give any points for what you do, or did I truly miss points that you
Well, made? The seven steps at the end were kind of seeing and doing steps.
Right, okay.
So how I broke it down was I talked about successful people see pressure as a push forward, and
right.
they believe that they possess the power to do something about the system.
Oh, okay. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
great.
And then I gave analogies. Yeah.
Right. And
okay.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, that's okay. If you got it, then you got it. That's great.
Okay. Yes, because I bunched everything up into what you see, but I see now that you can. Okay,
yeah.
Great. So I can just divide it that way. Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Great.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Denise. All right, we have one more caller. But, Tim, I'm going to interject a quick question for you. On your practical statements at the end, you know, you said all of them seemed really straightforward. The one that seemed would be a challenge because of bias is your very first point. And I was going to ask you, you know, your thoughts on this, of embracing a realistic view of what's really at stake. Do you typically rely on yourself, or do you enlist those close around you to get some input for that?
John, it's a great question, and I would say the answer is both. Here's why I think it needs to be you and someone. First of all, only you know what's really inside of you. You know how some people say, oh, you can never do that, but you know you have the drive to do it, and you go, well, I'm going to eliminate your opinion and go with my opinion, you know. So I think it does need to be partly you. But one of the reasons I think it's helpful to enlist someone you respect on that answer is they can help you through your cognitive distortions. So most of you have probably heard that term. It's a psychological term. But we are in a day where there are people struggling with cognitive distortions. They are exaggerating. You know, it's the typical teenager that goes, nobody loves me. You know, that's a cognitive distortion because mama loves you. You know, we are in a day of hyperbole and exaggeration, and our text messages are 3 exclamation points with all caps. It's ridiculous. And so when we feel overwhelmed, very often, not all the time, but often, it's because we're suffering from a distortion, and we need someone to say, no. It's not the end of the world. You're not going to die. You're fine. Don't we need people like that sometimes to talk us off the ledge? And
yeah,
so,
exactly.
So, John, I would say it's a little of both. You need to know what's in you, and you need someone else that you really respect that believes in you and say, John, you can do this. So I'll stop there.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. It just struck me as I was looking through that bias could get in the way. But I love your answer.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. I think we've got a couple more people in the queue, so let's go back to them real quick here. Okay. And you said before it's Ilya?
It's Ilyan. It's Ilyan again.
Ilyan.
John,
Ilyan.
The question, John, the question is for you. Where can I hear the recording again?
It's under the mentorship call library, and it's the leadership content partners, the leadership content partners call library. So that's it's on the very first page of the folders of each of the calls there. So you'll see it called that leadership content partners call library.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Sure. Take care. All right, and Dr. Arnie Miller, you're up next.
Thank you very much. Tim, great talk today. I have a question because I have, two teenage grandchildren, and I'm watching a deterioration of their interaction with their parents. So my question is, how do you reach out to the parent itself, because certainly, you know, they're raising their kids, and I'm listening to you, and I'm following what you have written, and all those things would be so great if kids could be better understood by their parents. And I think the difficulty I'm seeing is that parents don't, everyday parents don't really buy into what you're doing. Okay, most of the time, because they don't really understand their kids. And so, therefore, there's this misfiring of information back and forth. And I'm seeing it happen, right, in my own family. And I told my son the other day that, you know, I just asked him, I said, did we raise you this way? I mean, because I was trying to think back.
Yeah.
And he said to me, well, Dad, you know, things are different now. I knew you were going to be on today. So, Tim, look, I really love what you're doing, and I want to work with kids because I really think that the kids are going to be the salvation of our world out there, so that if we give them the right recognition, teach them the right ways, and I love all your analogies and metaphors because they really make it worthwhile. As an educator, I can relate to everything you're doing. So what do you do in a case where you have parents that you know are not on the same line as their children, and the kid is trying to be heard and understood, but not working?
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's the number one question we're trying to answer for teachers, parents, aunts and uncles, coaches, even employers that employ young people. I don't know if I've got a great answer that's short. I think I've got a good answer that's long, and it's too long. But I did a book a few years ago where I really tried to respond to that big $64,000 question. And the book was called 12 Huge Mistakes Parents Can Avoid. I found a common thread around the country and really in many ways around the world. I see it in Singapore and Brazil and other places we've been to. There is not only a new generation of kids on our hands today, we have a whole new generation of parents that will say things like your son said, well, it's different today. And it seems to excuse us from intentionality. I think the number one thing we need to be as parents is intentional. We realize what smartphones are doing to us, or we realize we're not really communicating well because it feels like a cross-cultural interaction with our teenagers. We've got to stop down and be very intentional. So the little acronym I tend to give to adults who say they care is, this is a leg we have to stand on. We've all heard that term, the leg you have to stand on. A leg is A-L-E-G. So the letter A is, I need to come with preformed questions and ask. I need to ask them questions. So maybe that's not the problem, but if it were, well, let me just tell you what I did. When my kids were still in the house, I'd drive up into the driveway, and I would come up with either four or five questions about their day. I would say to myself, well, I know Bethany had an audition today. I want to make sure and ask her about this. Or Jonathan had the exam today. I want to make sure and ask him about that. But what I was doing was I was trying to transfer from my work world, which had nothing to do with them, so to speak, but I wanted to make sure I was on the same page with them. So getting ready to ask them questions. The letter L, obviously, is listen well. So ask questions, listen well. If I ask but I don't listen, that's going to feel to them like, well, you came up with a good question, but all you were doing is waiting for it was your turn to talk. The letter E is empathize. So when I listen, they feel heard, and I think kids need to feel heard. But when I empathize, they feel understood. There's a big difference. Well, not a big difference. There's a little difference. I feel like when I'm able to maybe respond back with a simple phrase like, oh, my gosh, I bet that made you feel horrible, or something like that. You know, that's just good interaction. And then the letter G in a leg is guide. But I only have the right to guide when I practiced asking, listening, empathizing, asking, listening, empathizing. So if indeed the interaction part was the hard part, that might be a little batting order to follow. But, you know, we've been talking about these habitudes, and please forgive me if I'm going too much to the well, but we started using habitudes at our dinner table once a week when our kids were growing up. There was one metaphor or image on Monday night. It was habitudes night at dinner, so we knew we would all laugh and tell jokes and talk about the day, but they knew there was going to be something we were going to talk about, like the iceberg or the diamond secret or whatever. And pictures are worth 1,000 words. So I don't know. Maybe that would be something that would be helpful. I'll stop there. Now I'm just kind of waxing eloquent, and maybe it's not helping, but that would be
no, no. No, Tim, it's fantastic because I think we need journeys to be taken by parents, but in a way in which they will understand their children better. Because I've coached a couple of kids, and the things the kids tell me, my parents don't seem to understand what I'm thinking and how I act and how I'm responding in this world today. That was my 14-year-old told me that. And without his parents being around. So I said, wow, when someone's thinking like that at 14, I mean, you have to have a different approach and try to understand who is that person that you're raising. So I'm going to get, I think what I'll do is I'll go and purchase the books. And I asked you this question before in another session. When you do turn this over, I want to be in line to get certified so that we can lend all this and I can make it work because I won't be frustrated, you know, in terms of making people feel that they're on the right track, the parents and the kids.
Yeah, you're spot on, and I'm so glad you're in the fight. I mean that in a good way. We've got to battle for the future of our kids. They will be not only adults one day soon, they'll be leaders. whether we like it or not, whether they're ready or not. Yep. So I appreciate it. I know we'll get the word out about the Habitude certification. Mark Cole and I have talked about launching at an IMC, whether it's this next one in August or the next one in March. And I hate to promise anything because, you know, things are always changing. But that's my hope, and I'm hoping we'll at least have a lab and then an ongoing, hey, let's get you certified to use these tools in your tool belt to better connect with the next generation. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for your time. John, thank you very much. You always bring great people to the table, including yourself. So thanks for the education.
Well, thank you, Arnie. Good to hear your voice. Okay. Well, Tim, that looks like the end of the queue. I usually just say if anybody wants to hop in one more, we've got room for another question. Otherwise, in a few seconds, I'm going to turn it back over to you, Tim. And I'll tell you what, why don't we, I'm going to go ahead and. I'll take it this way, Tim. I'm going to turn over to you. Give us the last word as we close out this and head on into the rest of this Easter weekend. And thank you so much, by the way, for this incredible teaching.
Good. Well, John, I love working with you, and it's fun to be with a fellow educator, if not in job at heart. So that's always fun. Well, I want to close with a quick story and a point to that story. Remember, point, picture, practice. Sorry for drilling that into you over and over and over. One of the greatest stories of what we talked about today was a young kid named Louis who lived during the 19th century. Louis was a young child, like let's say 3 years old, maybe 4 years old. He was preschool. And this was a long time ago, but Louis was in his father's shed, and his father had some tools in his shed. And remember, Louis's really young, so he grabbed hold of an awl. Do you remember the tool called an awl? It was one of those, it had a big round handle on it, but it had a sharp point on the other, and it was often used to maybe make a hole in a piece of leather to make a belt. But Louis grabbed this awl, and he was fiddling around with it, and he accidentally poked out one of his eyes. It was tragic. Well, it hurt like crazy, and he cried and talked to his parents, and they tried to, you know, put a bandage on it and nurse him back to comfort again. But that all that went in his eye had so infected that area that the infection went over to the other eye. And before too long, young Louis was completely blind in both eyes. Well, they debated over the next year or two before school would actually start for Louis, where should we send him to school? Because back then in France, that's where he lived. You know, there just weren't schools that were suited for the blind, or at least not that many. But they did find one school outside of Paris that was specifically designed for the seeing impaired. And so they drove, they didn't drive, they took Louis over to this school, and they placed him in the school. But Louis quickly discovered at a young age, elementary school that would be, that it was really for seeing impaired students, not for people that were completely blind. In other words, the tool that they used to, the system that they used to help kids read was really designed for the military on a dark night where they could kind of see something. It was lifted up, but they could see it in the dark, but barely. Well, Louis couldn't see anything, so no matter what it was, dark or light, that didn't help him. So at the age of 12, young Louis began to create a new system. It took him 3 years, but by the age of 15, Louis had invented a system to read for the blind. Now, keep in mind, he's a teenager, and the system he came up with is still used to this day. His name was Louis Braille, and every one of us has heard of the Braille system of reading for the blind. It's used globally. He did it as a young leader at 15 years old. Now, can I tell you the cool part about the story? The very tool that blinded, the very tool that blinded Louis at the age of 3 was the one he used to create a system for the blind at 15. He took that awl and he began to poke and prod and create holes and lifted letters and so forth. but he took the very item that would have ruined most kids and used it and leveraged it, almost like he discovered the diamond secret, that pressure isn't the problem, it's the solution. Isn't it true that some of the greatest stories in the world, the very item that was designed, at least it feels like, to throw us on our knees, thrust us forward to the answer? So let's take a note from the page of Louis Braille's story and say, I don't care what happens, I'm going to leverage it for good, and I'm going to build some grit in the process. So love hanging out with you all. John, I'll turn it back over to you.
Awesome. What a powerful closing statement there. I had no idea of that story. Thank you so much, Tim. Thank you all for hanging with us on this Saturday morning. I know you got lots out of this. I'm going to take us off mute so you can all say bye, and we'll get on with our Easter weekend. Y'all have a great weekend ahead.
Bye.
Thank you. Have a great day. Take care.